Episode 4 of Season 17, I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is Geek Speak. In the air with me is Mr. Brian Young. He's a computer software developer, maker, and family man. Hi, Brian.
Family man.
Family man.
Nice yes, there.
That was nice, huh?
Yes, I am a family man. How you doing, Lyle?
I'm quite well, thank you. It's good to see you. We also have Mr. Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe is a software engineer working for Facebook on video type things, but also has an amazingly cool podcast, which we've mentioned before. What's your most recent episode?
Oh, it's called Geek Speak, actually.
The other one, Linear Digressions.
Yeah, I also do Linear Digressions. It's on data science and machine learning. And this is actually not the most recent episode. We did a show January 8th called Zero Shot Translation, where we talk about Google Translate and kind of some of the difficulties of spinning up a new language, and also some of the benefits that they got from using neural nets to do the translations, as opposed to their previous methodologies.
I think we covered a bit about Google's breakthrough recently on Geek Speak, but we didn't go into the details of how the algorithms work, which of course your show is all about how the learning works for machines.
Yeah, and the announcement that they made is that in the last year they've made more progress than they have in the decade before that.
Wow,
which is pretty incredible.
That's amazing.
So machine learning for the win. Go ahead and listen to that episode.
Was it your show that I heard that part of the reasons they had a giant win is they used a hardware level adding system that didn't actually add perfectly?
Oh yeah, we did do an episode where we were talking about that, I think.
Fuzzy Edition or something? I can't remember what it's called.
Either that or we both listened to the same different podcast.
That might be it too.
And we both remember it. But yeah.
Well, if that kind of brain candy of like how machines actually learn and how this works, we talk a lot about on Geekspeak as well. If you haven't listened to Linear Digressions, I urge you to do so because Ben's co-host is an expert in the field and what they talk about is pretty cool.
She's the one who actually knows everything.
Yeah.
I just ask silly questions.
Hey, that's my job here. Speaking of silly questions, what's going on with pig hybrids?
What kind of question is that?
A silly question.
The thing that's wonderful about this story is that you've denoted it in our show page as follow-up, human-pig hybrid created in the lab. Here are the facts. We never talked about human-pig. So I don't know what the follow-up nature is. Please explain.
Okay, so here on Geekspeak, we often wander into topics that we are clear that we don't know enough about.
Yes.
Yeah, so, heavy biology and as well as ethics are an area that I'm not fully comfortable talking about this story. So this is follow-up because several weeks ago on the January 7th episode, we were talking about the ethics involved in autonomous cars and how it is predicted to lead to a shortage of donors for
organ donors. Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, of course, accidents go down in cars. Yay! But now we have the other problem of we need more organs for an already short supply of organ donors. Well, in the lab, some scientists have created a chimera, a human pig chimera. So what this is they're aiming to be able to fill that need for organ donations.
What is a chimera?
It is where you are mixing the cells of two different creatures. So the idea is, the goal is to be able to grow an organ, a human organ, in another animal.
I'm sorry. I thought I was going crazy and I looked this up. Indeed, a chimera or whatever it is indeed a fire-breathing female monster with a lion's head, a goat's body, and a serpent's tail from Greek mythology.
And also a great monster in D&D. So that's why I know what the chimera is.
That's funny. And you say chimera.
Yes.
No.
But that's okay.
Wait, where's Miles when we need him?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. No, he would know. But okay, so it's actually a real thing as well in biology.
Well, they, of course, took it from the Greek myths as far as their naming goes. And this is not something that's going to grow organs tomorrow. It's going to be quite a while. In fact, when you read through the story, you realize how early on in the process they are. But they were able to, at an early stage of
embryo?
Embryo. It's actually the blastocyst. I'm not pronouncing that right, I'm sure.
It's one of the stages.
Yes, one of the stages. They're able to inject some stem cells and
human stem cells
into a pig embryo. And they grow into a chimera where there is a mix of human and pig cells. It is nowhere near the point of being useful. In fact, they are thinking it's going to be more useful for studying diseases that are related to genetics and so on.
But the general idea would be you'd grow a pig that would actually have a human heart at some level.
That's the goal. And of course, this is filled with ethic challenges and everything else. So from one ethical problem of autonomous cars to the ethical problem of growing human organs.
Can I just take it from the 14-year-old me?
Yes.
Whoa, that's so cool! And not think about the ramifications of how bad that could be for society. And awesome as well.
Wait, that sounds like a temporal paradox.
Sure, I'll go with that. Did you guys hear about the Tennessee governor who actually wants to pass a law that would allow co-ops in the state of Tennessee, power grid co-ops? There's actually 37% of Tennessee population is serviced by 23 different nonprofit electric co-ops.
So you know, 70. What are the numbers again?
30. Okay, so 2.5 million residents of Tennessee, which is about 37% of the population.
Okay, so like a third of the population
gets electricity from co-ops, nonprofit corporations that provide electricity. So in the area that I live in, it's very common to have like a shared well, and sometimes you make a nonprofit organization for that so that there's a body that can receive taxes and kind of manage the system. Mm-hmm. In Tennessee, electrical systems work in that fashion.
Wow.
We have a co-op. And that's a lot of people, 2.5 million people served by these nonprofits. So the governor, Bill Hostelman, a Republican, last week announced legislation that would allow those same nonprofits that run electricity grids to provide telco services, specifically internet access, which is way cool.
Interesting. That's cool.
Surprise, surprise, AT&T and other telcos don't want them to do that. But this is actually a kind of a collaborative effort with these organizations and with cities, because cities aren't legally allowed to provide internet access to people outside of their area. And so this would actually allow for like a second leg. So the city, the metropolitan area that has good bandwidth could lease the bandwidth to these electrical companies, which could then resell to the customers, all under corporate and nonprofit organization structure. But basically the big reason for this is that those little tiny electrical companies that are nonprofits deal with regions that are not served because there's not high density of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the place where the ISPs in this country don't serve very well because it doesn't pay them well to get the service
right
in there.
But that's never stopped them from fighting the possibility of this before.
Right, because if they – I mean, they're definitely fighting it because it makes sense to fight it from their business perspective. They don't want more competitors. Even if they're not going after that market right now, they don't want that market to be served by somebody else because then, of course, later it would be challenging for them to go after the market.
I'm torn about this. You say it makes sense for them, except for all of the internet providers are – well, all the big ones are trying to become something more than a dumb pipe. That's the thing they're fighting against. And yet these co-ops, that's essentially what they're trying to become because they're trying to make a cheap, dumb pipe. So come on, big business, back off.
Speaking of ISPs, why don't you go ahead and talk to us about Comcast?
Yeah, so I haven't seen this myself. You have Comcast, Lyle.
I do.
I don't know if you do, Ben.
I do.
Have you seen a page in HTML injected message about your Comcast usage?
I haven't. Are they doing – that sounds like a really bad idea. I mean, as a web developer, I mean.
Which is exactly what the problem that this article is addressing. Yes.
Almost all the traffic I engage with is HTTPS, and I haven't given authority to them for certificates. So they would be – it would be hard-pressed for them to insert it. Though – I have a whole problem with Comcast and bandwidth limits.
Which is what the story is about. The reason why they are injecting a in-page pop-up, it's not a separate window, it's just adding HTML and CSS to the page so that you see a message about you getting close to or going over your monthly data plan.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been going over yours?
Yeah. In December, I went over mine. Now, keep in mind, I had family in town. So I had my sister and her three kids and other people all using our bandwidth.
How many devices at once?
I don't even know. And then also my mother and her husband stayed in our cabin at the property as well. So there's lots of usage. So we went over our terabyte. Is it really that much? And we went over in December. And I thought, well, maybe this is an anomaly. And they're giving... Comcast has said very clearly, they texted me, they called me, they emailed me. They're very clear that this is happening. I got lots of notifications. I didn't notice that them tampering with my data like that by injecting stuff.
So to be clear,
yeah,
the reason that this is awkward and weird is that, let's say I go to, I don't know, some website that's HTTP that's not encrypted, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say it's a website like Reddit or something. I assume that what I get back from Reddit is just from Reddit, right?
Right.
But if you have someone in the middle who's putting stuff in there, I mean, it could be something innocuous like Comcast adding a little dialogue that says, hey, you're over your thing. But it could be nefarious potentially too. And that's really kind of the sketchy middle ground is like
AT&T and Verizon were both doing injections like this last year or 2 years ago, and they were putting unique cookies into the stream, a unique ID inside the header, which allowed tracking of their customers to advertisers.
Right.
And they got a lot of flack for that. It's the same pattern that Comcast is using in this situation exactly.
Right. So it's not them just sending you a notification. It's them doing something that is potentially actually potentially dangerous to send you a message.
Yeah, modifying a payload of a page is not a good idea. Right. I mean,
this is the whole reason we have encryption.
A simple example of this is that I've built in the past scraping utils that will modify, you know, read through a page and do certain things. We had I used to be in a flood zone, and I had a system that would go and scrape a website that was generated by somebody to pull data out of it. And that wasn't HTTP, and it wasn't a REST protocol, but it was something that was really important to the entire community I lived in, because we wanted to get notifications of when flood ratios changed. And so that was a scraping. If this injection had happened, my script would have possibly broken.
Right. That's an example of like something that they're definitely not considering that could be problematic.
Right.
Or their system gets compromised and then your system gets compromised.
Well, the long and the short of this is that this month I also went over even without family visiting. So I went in and spent the $50 more to get unlimited data from Comcast. So now I'm giving them more money.
And your actual bandwidth is the same speed?
Yes. And I can't get a clear number on what my speed is supposed to be, because when I tried to buy the 100 or the 200 whatever, they gave me a speed boost on my base. So basically they can't provide the service they want to provide. So they advertise all the time they can give me 200 megabit. But when I try to buy that, they say, oh, well, and they don't. But they constantly send me flyers. Hmm. So irritating.
So what was the best speed test you've gotten out of it?
I'll check it again. Yeah, I haven't checked it lately.
I'm getting over the 100 megabit right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I had to get a new modem to take advantage of that.
Let's talk about JavaScript. Since we're talking about injection, what they're doing is modifying the payload. Mm-hmm. The programming language that they could actually do weird and horrible things, which is why we've moved to HTTPS specifically. The programming language, of course, is JavaScript.
Right.
But reality,
not to be confused with Java.
Right. They're totally different things. And the official name for JavaScript is actually ECMA script.
ECMA script.
ECMA, because the console that organizes it is the ECMA group.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's technically true. And JavaScript is not a term for everyone to use. So although people colloquially call it JavaScript, it's actually ECMA script.
Yeah, I mean, another way to think about it is that there was this group that made ECMAScript, and then at the same time, Java was popular, and they wanted a scripting language in the browser, and so they used JavaScript as the name, the common name for it.
Yeah.
I don't know who owns the rights to JavaScript. I don't think it's a trademark thing. I think it's in the practice now.
Okay. Well,
it doesn't matter. What's going
on
with ECMAScript?
But anyway, basically the deal is, so before we had all these versions, you'd have ECMAScript 3, ECMAScript 4, which we don't talk about, and ECMAScript 5, also known as ES5, just for simplicity. So they came out with ES6, and then people were like, you know what, let's just change the way we do things. Instead of releasing these big bundles of features, let's just release a new one every year, and whatever features get in, and whatever features don't get in, right? So ECMAScript 2017 is now...
Oh, and specifically 6 switched to EMC 16,
became
2016.
15.
Oh, 15, okay.
ES6 became 15. What was ES7 in planning is now ECMAScript 2016. And let's stop talking about ES6
17, the one that will come out now, this year at some point.
Now.
Okay,
cool. It just advanced to
stage
4.
What's in the features?
So the major new features are async functions and shared memory and atomics, which that second one is something I don't know anything about. I need to read an article on it.
Shared memory between processes?
Shared memory and atomics.
Between worker threads?
Don't ask me for clarification. And some more minor new features are object.values and object.entries, object.getOwnProperty descriptors, trailing commas and function parameter lists and calls, and string padding. String padding, I thought, was already in ES 2016, but I guess I was wrong about that. Now it is officially stage 4, which means it's like browser vendors should implement this. People should use it.
What
is
string padding? What does it do?
String padding is like, let's say that you have... first of all, what's a string? One of my favorite strings is B-E-N, Ben. It's just, a string is just a collection of letters, right? So it could be L-Y-L-E or B-R-I-A-N or Ben. So let's say that I needed that string to be a certain number of characters for some reason. And one example of that is if you're dealing with numbers and you have some single-digit numbers and some double-digit numbers and you want them to align properly, there are a whole bunch of uses of this. That would be...
I've used that specifically for building out the Geekspeak website. When you navigate Geekspeak website, you'll notice the URL space right now is year, month, and day. And of course, months that are single years, I actually want to have two digits.
Yeah, so you want to say months are single digits.
Yeah.
Instead of just one for January.
Exactly.
Right. So so they were working on the API for this. And I thought that the API was something like your string.padLeft and then some stuff telling it what to pad and how much to pad. Mm-hmm. And then there's also a pad right. So so I was reading the API and I was surprised to see indeed it is not pad left and pad right. It is pad start and pad end.
Ah, for right to left languages.
For right to left languages.
Sure.
So I thought that this was just kind of an interesting entry point for talking just generally about the difficulty of making APIs.
Wait, that means that they have to have some kind of declaration of what language the string is in. For start and end to actually mean anything, you have to be able to set it.
Right.
So do you set it at the global level or you must have to set it at the string level? Fascinating. The term string comes from a string of characters, doesn't
right.
it? And it, of course, in traditional force, like in C, when you want to hold a whole bunch of characters, you actually hold a character array. And then that character array is a whole bunch of characters strung together. And that's, I think, where the term came from.
Right.
But it does mean text, basically. So do you find anything out about – I'm really curious about how you declare the language – if you're in left to right or right to left. Because you have to be able to toggle that.
I don't know. You can Google it if you want.
I'll look it up.
I don't know. But I think the thing that just looking at it kind of at a more cursory glance level, the thing that's kind of interesting to me is just to see or is to think about when you're designing an API like that and you're thinking about it a lot, you are making a bunch of assumptions based on the use cases you're thinking about and your own context.
Mm-hmm.
So the use cases might be like, okay, well, I want to be able to pad it with zeros, right? Because probably everyone's just going to use this to pad it with zeros. So you make an API where you say, oh, I want the character zero five times or whatever it is, right? But what if you want the character AB repeated before? I mean, that's probably a bad example, but I'm sure there are plenty of use cases of this. So you want to make an API that is general enough that it can be used for all of the different possible use cases,
mm-hmm.
many of which you can't possibly ever think about, right? But then additionally, you need to keep your own context in mind. So the example of pad start, pad end versus pad left, pad right is I live in a country where all of the languages that I ever encounter are left to right, pretty much, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that are right to left, if I ever encounter them, I don't even know they're right to left because they're signs I can't read. So I have this core understanding that strings read from left to right.
Right,
and
Exactly.
And if I don't work with internationalizing strings, I don't even know I have that implicit bias.
Another way to think about this, though, is if you're just thinking of the string not as a language but as a collection of things and you want to put stuff on the left or put stuff on the right, that's totally valid. There's nothing wrong with that idea. But normally these represent languages. And if you write your code to say, I'm going to add zeros to the left, when you try to translate your code, you have a serious problem because
mm-hmm.
no point in there is it say these are supposed to go on the start of the language on the left or right, depending on if it's a left or right language. Instead, you have this code that's kind of littered throughout, and there's no way for any system to say, oh, no, what we should do when you say left pad is put it on the right now, because maybe you're just making some line art.
Right.
So there's different uses for it. This same type of pattern hit CSS, and there's patterns for this in CSS,
mm-hmm.
and you'll see that the more recent CSS rules, CSS is cascading style sheets, it's the styling of websites. So there's three things that make up a web page. There's JavaScript, which we've been talking about, ECMAScript. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the stuff that does stuff.
Yeah, it's the action stuff. There's the HTML, which is kind of the meaning.
The stuff that is... stuff is done too.
And then the CSS, which is the styling. the color and all that.
Actually, you can think almost, this is like a very simple spitting way to think about it, but your CSS is like your adjectives, your HTML is like your nouns, and your JavaScript is like your verbs.
Mm-hmm. In any case, in CSS, there's ways to say I'm doing right to left. In fact, all the patterns of Flexbox work this way, mm-hmm. so that the things flow in start to end, the same type of terminology. Yeah. And so when you say I want to flow this to the start, when you go to right to left, it's going to be on the right side. When you go to left to right, it's going to be on the left side. It's really cool.
Or it might be top to bottom. And Flexbox actually allows for that too.
Same deal. We actually have a lot of language support, of course, in the iOS app that I work on at work. And this is one of the things that we can just toggle to see it in a different language. And sure enough, if you do everything right, it floats perfectly. But if you make one of these little mistakes of saying, I want, you know, this much percentage in the left side, you got a problem.
Right. Absolutely. And this is the problem that pretty much probably any company that gets to the point where they need to translate into languages that are doing right to left are like, oh, crap. Okay, there's a lot of work ahead of us. We need to like rewrite a bunch of stuff because we built this on shaky foundations mm-hmm. with our basic assumption. But anyway, as a very big picture final point, this is the reason that these APIs get proposed, and then you wait around for a year or two or three before they are locked in cement, and browser vendors can like really do it and implement it, and people can rely on it. It's because you need a little bit of time to shake out the bugs and for the community to look over the stuff before it gets cemented down.
And what's really cool about what the ECMA is doing now is that the task force is actually saying, okay, we're going to try to finish this pad left, or this padding system. Yeah. It's in stage 4. It probably will finish in 2017. If we can't come to conclusion because we feel like there's other things we're not solving, we just won't ratify it this year and it will go into 2018. So that general idea means that this padding of strings padding might have been worked on for 2 years. It just happens to be hitting this year, which is cool, the way that group works.
Which is actually the way most of the software industry is actually releasing continuously. Your browsers are released continuously, and now the language itself is being developed continuously.
Yeah, and a small correction, you said stage 4 and it'll move on, but stage 4 is actually finished. So stage 3 is candidate.
Oh, cool.
And then stage 4 is, yep, we're done.
We accepted it.
We accepted.
Cool. So it's done.
Stage 0, I love the name for stage 0, is straw man.
Yes.
Which is like, yeah, this is a load of crap. Yeah. And then 1 is proposal, 2 is draft, 3 is candidate, which means it's probably not going to change. And then 4 is, yep, we're done.
And to be clear, the process of all this is actually very transparent. So you can actually engage in the entire process. Being on the committee, the TC39 committee, is much more strong than not being on the committee. But participation is not, you can participate at any level.
I just love the fact that you're talking about APIs and you're talking about how that can, how important it is to get it right. I think it's a great lesson for diversity in tech mm-hmm. as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, there's just one example of why you need to be able to think about other languages, which, you know, I can see how even Western-speaking programmers are going to have to confront that. But what about all the other diversity issues in tech? I saw this tweet that said, this is how you can tell Google Maps was designed by men. And it showed at 12 o'clock at night the walking directions going right through a cemetery to get to another spot. Of course, this is a woman that was tweeting this out.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But these are all the kind of issues that diversity helps when you're trying to design
right.
something that's going to be used.
Right.
Do you guys know about Project Implicit? This thing called Project Implicit, it's implicit.harvard.edu. It's a project which basically shows your implicit biases that you have by allowing you to
fantastic.
Take online tests. So I just did one. We're doing some today because we're going to have a large discussion about the process at work for hiring and being more diverse in hiring. And we want to actually trickle it down to the entire staff, because the more we're aware of it, the more we can try to compensate for our own biases. And so I did one today on gender, which is – doing these suck. Because you think you're a good person, and then you do this. And so basically this test, which I'm going to link to on the site, you guys can all take it as well. This was on company and professional life versus personal and family life, and male and female. So you get a whole bunch of names of people, and they're given to you first time. Like there's 8 names that are male and 8 names are female, and they show them to you. And they say, okay, now what we're going to do is take the A key and the I key, or the E key and the I key, and that's the left side and the right side of the keyboard. Mm-hmm. And we're going to say, if you see a name that shows up on the screen that's a male name, push the left side. And if it's a female name, push the right side. So you go through it as fast as you possibly can, doing it over and over again. I messed up on Michelle a few times. I kept on reading as Michael. But in general, that one's relatively easy because it's just like recognize and you've kind of isolated those off. Then they show you words that are related to the business life or personal life. So family or home or relatives mm-hmm. versus salary and corporation and management. And so there's like eight of all these groups. Then they do those things on top of each other. So they say, okay, take corporate life and male things and put them on the left and take female and family stuff and put it on the right. Now, after you do that for a while, you then invert it and you're supposed to do this as fast as possible so you make mistakes. Now, put family life on the left-hand side and male on the left-hand side and corporate on the right-hand side and female on the right-hand side. And the end of that process, they look at all your errors and mistakes. Mm-hmm. It takes you longer cognitively to react if it's a disassociation in your groupings, even inherently non-conscious. And sure enough, I was I relate men and business and female and home more than the other way around.
Right.
So I'm biased, which I knew.
And you're not a bad person because of that.
No, it's actually you can't do anything about it in some
you
ways
can't do
except
anything,
for yeah. be aware of it.
Right. Yeah. Be aware of it and also do things to counteract that bias if you can.
Yes. Which yes. is the tricky thing because how much do you counteract it? How much do you compensate
right.
for it? And in any case, we're doing that work, and I urge you to do this. If you've never done one of these, they're great. There's a whole bunch of tests. I did one on gender, but there's race, and there's skin tone, and there's presidents, and about Native Americans, and weight, and age. And basically, it's gonna get you to be aware of your own bias. It's hard to do.
It's really hard to do.
It really is.
Yeah. It feels really like if the results come out more negatively than you are hoping they will, it feels really, really bad.
Yeah.
But it's better to feel bad about it than to believe that it's not a thing.
And, you know, I've always really liked the idea that our human perception – and being aware that our human perception is bad. And a great way to see that is to see optical illusions where, you know, you give in two spheres and in a drawing and one's on a black background, one's on a gray background, and you're like, oh, that one looks bigger, and then you measure it and like, nope, you're wrong. To be aware that you're fallible gives you an ability to re-question everything you know. And mm-hmm. this is very similar in that way. When you see that you have bias, it's similar to being able to see the optical illusions exist. Your mind has problems and faults and you have to compensate for it. When we did this test at work, when our manager asked us to do it, I wrote back, oh, good, a test that will make me feel horrible. any case, though, I'm glad I did it. And sharing it, of course, is a good thing because all people can be aware of their bias. So I'll link that to the Geek Speak show page. Let's talk about, well, I guess, Brian, you and I both paid to this Kickstarter campaign.
Oh, yeah.
To try to support microblogging. Can you tell me what microblogging is?
I think the easiest way to explain it to people is Twitter. So the whole idea of microblogging is putting up very, very short messages onto something you can call a blog to publish your ideas. It's a publishing platform.
Tumblr was the first one I was aware of. I think I still have microblog.lyle.troxel.com points to my Tumblr.
Did they actually – I mean, was that in common use, that term?
I think microblog was in common use at that time, yeah.
Until this project, which this is a developer I follow his podcast as well, and he's been talking about it for quite a while. He's just getting to the point where it's public, but that was the first time I'd heard this term. But the whole idea is that we have blogging platforms out there, WordPress and such, that you can do generally long-form writing or at least something that's not considered to be a tweet size.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to encourage this microblogging because he's seen the inadequacies of systems like Twitter that are controlled by companies.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, any of the social media platforms where you're using somebody else's site, they tend to set it up that they own the content or they control the content, and you can't just easily take your words with you later.
Well, yeah, more than that, the way you access it and everything is through their system. So if you're not participating, you don't really have access to it.
And extending systems like that is usually hard or impossible. Now, Twitter used to have quite a good relationship with developers, allowing people to build applications and services on top of it. And then they had times where they cut that off or at least curtailed it quite a bit.
Yeah, and Twitter does still have a working API. If you don't hit a maximum load that's too high, you can access all your feeds. And Facebook has the same type of thing. So you can actually, as a Facebook app or a Twitter API user, you can actually go and grab the data that's part of your account. But there's complexity to that because, of course, in these social networks, especially something like Facebook's complexity, when I say I want my experience on Facebook, how much of your experience do I take? Because, of course, my experience is your posts, and your posts are your property, not really mine. So this is a very strange place where you can't really replicate the system after it's been produced because it has its own structure. It already is a complex system. So what is the idea behind this Kickstarter campaign? Explain it to me.
Okay. So first of all, the developer's name is Manton Rees, and he's been developing this for a while. The whole idea behind this is he wants to use platforms like WordPress to be able to set up these microblogs. And this Kickstarter campaign is not for raising money to build that platform, but instead raising money to publish a book on how this can be built. And it also is a way to fund his effort to also build a system where people could come and subscribe to and use his service. Mm-hmm. But he's doing it in an open source way where anybody could replicate the service and make their own microblog using their own installation of WordPress or some other system. Mm-hmm. And the idea behind this is publishing should be free. Our thoughts should be ours. We should have control over our content, and we should be able to publish it to the world and build on top of a system where it's open, that everybody can be in an environment where they are able to read the published works in the way they think is best. Mm-hmm. So it's a really laudable idea. Of course, we've heard social networks, people in the past trying to build social networks to compete with Facebook or anybody else, the Facebook killers. So Manton's whole philosophy is he's starting small. He wants to just do this microblog where he's not trying to build out some really large system that can handle everything that Twitter can handle. But he's going to give publishers, you and me, the ability to publish our thoughts this way and build on top of that. Now, we've talked a lot in the past about Twitter's downside. There's so much trolling and abuse that goes on Twitter. And he also wants to build into his platform tools that give the user control to be able to avoid the worst things of Twitter that you see.
I back this too, because for years I've felt like we take this wonderful open web concept and we invest our time and energy into these siloed systems, which are not the open web.
Right.
But they are so awesome.
Right? Well, okay, what makes them good? It makes them good because they put so much money into building a system that's efficient and that is able to handle the load.
It's not just the load, though. It's also the capabilities of all the users participating and of the systems having easy ways of referencing to each other. I mean, and a great example of that is on GitHub. If I want to – when I'm participating, I can actually – tag you because you have a GitHub user account, and you get notified instantly that I've made a comment somewhere that I want you to take a look at without me like opening another system to email and all that. So having that unique ID that's short that allows me to reference you is extremely beneficial in software development sources, right?
Sure.
These kind of tools exist everywhere, but it only works if you have these kind of authoritative responses to names. An email at some level is that, but you know it's not as integrated as it could be. I'm not optimistic on the success of this because I've thought about this problem for a long time. ROFA, do you remember a file format RO something of a friend? Do you remember that file format?
Oh yeah,
I don't remember that one.
It's basically a document that declares all your relationships, and idea is that you would publish that file, and that would be the way to specify your social graph, and everyone would.
FOAF, friend of a friend.
Friend of a friend. Thank you very much.
So the problem with systems like that is you need adoption for it to take off. And
right.
And the problem with doing something like building out your own WordPress installation is you have to know enough that you can set that up. And, of course, there are online providers that make this easier. And his whole intention is to build a service that makes it absolutely dead simple, easy for people to jump onto this by using a subscription to his service.
Right. Again, another walled garden.
Yes, but how walled is it when you are making the techniques and the software available for other people to replicate?
So the FOAF file I have had on my site under...
Yeah, I just found it. I just found it.
You
I downloaded
mine?
It.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And it's an
/FOAF.RDF. I don't know what an RDF is.
Rich document format.
That's the lamest name for a file format.
Why?
I don't know.
You'd rather it be hypertext markup language?
Why not just... Okay, anyway.
Well, it's got a cousin, the RTF, right?
All right, rich text format, yeah. And then I opened it, and I was surprised. So I expected it to open up in my text editor.
When did it open up in?
No, there is an application on my computer that's like, RDFs. That's my jam. And that was Firefox, which I haven't opened up in a long time. So that opened up. And then I searched for Ben Jaffe inside of your FOAF file, and I found me.
Yeah, sure.
And then I found three SHA-1 sums.
Mm-hmm.
For
good question. What are those?
B7? Long stream characters.
I mean, this format obviously didn't take off. But the general idea would be...
You sure?
Yeah, for sure. Considering we don't know what the inbox SHA-1 is.
Inbox SHA-1 sum.
I'm assuming it's something that defines
also,
you.
Also, FOAF is just not... You can't pronounce it. It's a FOAF.
Yeah. I mean, so the general concept, though, is just like your social graph on Facebook, everyone would self-define their social graph. So at my own domain, I would have a file that would define all the friends I have and other people follow me as well. And then you'd use RSS as the way of integrating. But then you need a commenting system. I mean...
Well, there's also privacy ramifications. What if I don't want people to know that you and I are friends?
Right. Yeah. So there needs to be a layer of encryption built into the system.
Well, no, that's the
everybody
thing.
Everybody knows we're friends.
And I'm publishing it. And you have no control of me publishing that.
Right,
I'm a friend of yours.
Exactly. So if you use something like Facebook, although it's a system that's closed off, you, in a sense, have more control over your content because...
Somebody's thought it all through.
Someone saw it all through, and also someone is... what's the word I'm looking for? Someone is managing everyone's content as opposed to all of your friends individually... managing little pieces of your content, like the fact that Lyle and I are friends, managed by Lyle, and I don't have control over it. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. And I agree. This project has a long way to go and a lot against it.
And at the same time, I threw him money.
Yeah.
In fact, he's had quite a big response from this. He was just trying to get $10,000 to finish, get enough money to finish it, publishing his book. He is up to, as of tonight, over $73,000.
That's cool. Wow. And the thing is, this person's idea and concept and wanting to write a book around it and exploring it is a good thing, right? Because figuring out maybe another way to do this kind of system makes a lot of sense. Another, the benefit we get out of these social networks are transcendent of the technology we're currently using. So any academic research on this idea of helping computers participate in our social life in a way that we control makes a lot of sense. I'm sure there's lots of research going on around that in general, even at the companies that are kind of owning the social domain.
Well, I think it makes a lot of sense for microblogging specifically because the best example I can think of is Twitter. And the way Twitter was built, like many companies, it was built on investors, which means it has to grow to turn a profit in some way. And Twitter has had a very challenging time to make a long-term business out of their product. Whereas
most startups are accountable to somebody.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right, but yeah. There is a... previous way to build a business, which was the slow and not seen in tech very often kind of business. And if somebody can build an open source product that can grow and build that same, fill that same need, that would be fantastic.
I agree.
I think it's time for us to move on to our kind of longer form discussion. I'm a little sensitive about doing this discussion because I really want GeekSpeak to be as much technical as possible, and this touches so much upon the political. But let's go through it from the technical angles that we've got, but also from the personal experiences. Ben, tell me about your trip to SFO the other day.
Oh, yeah. So I went to – actually, this was last night. Oh, I'm feeling a little out of sorts because I was I went to bed at 2 a.m., and I normally go to bed at like 9:30
a.m. Oh, so you must be tired.
Yeah. So we headed up to the airport, my partner and I. Because there was a protest around the U.S. Customs and Border Control Agency not basically enforcing Trump's executive order against immigration from a particular list of countries and not enforcing the stay that was ordered by the federal judge. So this kind of gets a little bit complicated, and I'm not going to go too far into it. But I just spent time there at the protest that there was in the SFO International Terminal, and just hung out by the food station and passed out water bottles to people. And it was really great. It was fantastic.
Were there a lot of people there?
There were a lot of people there. There were a lot of people there.
Sergey Brin was there.
What's that?
Founder of Google was there.
Oh, yeah. Sergey Brin. Yeah, yeah. I guess he showed up. I didn't see him. but yeah, I mean, there was one protest on Saturday on the 28th. And then there was an additional protest just yesterday, which is the one that I went to. And a lot of people turned out for that, which really made me happy.
And at one point, the union of cab drivers,
I think it was the cab
decided
union.
To support the protest by doing a 1-hour moratorium on pickups and drop-offs
right.
to the airport. I wasn't sure the motivation for them to do that.
Was this San Francisco or was this JFK?
I think this was JFK.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was at SFO. Mm-hmm. I did not drive to JFK.
You also didn't fly to JFK.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They stopped serving JFK for 1 hour.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it reported without mentioning the 1 hour thing. So this was a short period of time where they did this. And
which also a 1 hour stop of service.
It's inconvenient.
It's inconvenient, but it doesn't mean a lot really when you're talking about an airport travel, you know. Pretty much everybody gives themselves an extra hour. Like that's a pretty common thing.
Well,
at some level.
Usually not after you get off the plane.
True.
To go home. Yeah, especially after if it's an international flight.
Additionally, if the strike happened and people weren't able to arrive to increase the – it could be seen as kind of a counter to the protest as well because it would stop inflow of more people participating.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
Of course, you drove.
If people are taking a cab to the airport.
All right. What's the tech side of this?
I lost my train of thought.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We're talking about Uber and
yes.
Okay. So basically, what happened was the cab company did this, not all ride sharing as well. This was specifically the cab company, and Lyft and Uber were still operating. Halfway through it, Uber the company Uber. Tweeted out that they were turning off surge pricing for that period of time.
What is surge pricing?
Surge pricing is if there are a lot of people trying to get rides, then Uber will say, okay, there's more demand than there is supply. So we're going to hike up the rates so that way the drivers can get more and probably also Uber can make a little bit more as well.
And
so,
if you're willing, if you don't want to wait, you just pay more money and then you get a ride faster.
If you do want to wait, you just wait a little bit longer and then the surge pricing goes away and you can get a normal price ride.
Oh, I think you explained it well. I just remember when I first heard about it, I thought that was evil. That's just gouging people. But the mechanism they're trying to encourage is to get more drivers.
Right, right, exactly. So if there's surge pricing and as a driver you're like, "Whoa, if I go to JFK right now, I can make two times the amount that I normally would," then all the drivers have incentive to go to JFK and
because
that
the choice for a driver to be to be on call or not is just a toggle switch, right? A driver mm-hmm. can be like, "I'm on right now. Oh, I'm off right now." Mm-hmm. You have to have a certain amount of hours on, I think, but in general, you can toggle
that.
You
get benefits if you have a certain number of hours on.
I see. So if they instigate surge, they'll actually add more people to the pool. And then once those get added to the pool after a certain period of time, the surge price would therefore decrease. So it kind of makes sense.
It makes sense.
A microeconomic kind of scale.
Especially so it would be especially evil if Uber did surge pricing and then just kept all the profits. That would be pretty evil. But the fact
okay, so
that,
what did they do?
So Nobis? They tweeted that they were turning off surge pricing for JFK. I think for JFK.
They were turning off surge pricing.
Turning off. So to me, reading this without the backlash that followed, to me that feels like okay, they are trying to not profit.
Yeah.
Seems like from this cab thing. So in a sense, it almost seems like they're kind of supporting or at least standing with in some fashion the taxi companies serving.
Why'd they tweet it though? It sounds kind of self-flagellation if they tweeted it.
I think they often do that. And it's probably – I mean you tweet things for publicity, right?
Well, they also tweeted something about the side effect of what would happen because they're turning off surging. Do you recall it? Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, so the tweet was that we're turning off surge pricing, so the wait might be longer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right.
There was this side effect that they were aware of what would happen. There would be less drivers potentially.
Right.
So from Uber's point of view, if they wanted to be in solidarity with the taxi drivers, what are their options? Their options are to divert cars from going to the airport?
Yeah, they could just say we're not going to serve JFK either. They could have done that.
Or they, by turning off the surge pricing, they are reducing the drivers that could be there through less
– Over the longer term though. Because if you turn on surge pricing, then a bunch of drivers will come to the airport, but there's a lag, right? They're not going to just immediately materialize. And given that they tweeted that at, I think, whatever the hour was, 37 or something?
So now that we've analyzed this and talked about what we thought and everything.
What was the backlash?
The backlash – the side effect of this sounds really shocking. So
the backlash was someone somehow interpreted Uber's actions as anti the protest and tweeted that, and that went viral, and people retweeted it, people reworded it, people didn't really check sources, and people – now there's a big thing of uninstall Uber. And it's odd because I am not – at all a fan of Uber. If I do rideshare, I always do Lyft. I try and stay away from Uber.
Why?
I mean, there are a number of reasons why. If you look at off the top of my head, I can't give you a clear list, but from my own personal experience of asking drivers who do both, they have said generally, on average, yeah, we really prefer Lyft more than Uber, but we do both of them because there's not enough volume only doing Lyft to make it work for me.
Well, and of course, the company has gotten in the news multiple times for various issues, including privacy. There's been two different stories over the last couple of years where they were actually following, or I should say employees at the company were following people directly in the system, and they didn't have the protections in place to keep privacy so that employees could look into the data of who's moving where, and including Hollywood stars and stuff.
Yeah, and there's other aspect that the executives have said pretty clearly that we're interested in producing self-driving cars so we don't have to have employees anymore. That's going to happen no matter what happens.
Right.
But at some level, being in a company where you've got thousands of employees that are actually not really employees, they're really contractors, and you're not really giving them benefits, there's a lot of questions about their success. It's interesting that you like Lyft comparatively. I don't really have an opinion one way or the other, but I haven't researched it.
I don't think Lyft is amazing, but I guess I'm not taking a hardline stance or making a clear statement on this right now because I don't feel I've done enough research to clearly say Lyft is better than Uber. But that's my feeling in the things that I've read and the people who work for that company that I've asked. But I guess basically like to kind of wrap this up into a point, it feels odd that there are – oh, and sorry, one more thing is that Uber is working with the Trump administration perhaps more actively than a lot of people who are anti-Trump would want.
And of course, politically, that's the tinder that allows us to become a wildfire.
Yeah. Yes. All of this to say, I guess – there are a lot of reasons why you might choose to uninstall Uber and only go with a competitor. But it seems like this being the
catalyst,
it's a really odd catalyst.
Yeah.
Because it feels almost like what they tweeted is the opposite of how people took it.
And there's a couple compounding aspects. We introduced this as the cab company was doing a one-hour strike, which we see is not a big thing in a lot of ways. They probably still gonna make the same amount of money that night, maybe not. But in the tweet and such, in the public face of that, the duration of the cab company strike was not stated. So one is cab company is striking and not servicing, and people go, yay, solidarity. And then the next one is Uber is still servicing everybody, right? And so they see you see the dichotomy. The thing that's frustrating about this is that the call to action to cancel your account goes out and you're not in support. And of course, the people that did not make it to one of these events to protest, they don't have a lot of affordance to participate except, oh, here's something I can do right now and it doesn't really affect my life very much. Just cancel the service. So it's one of those things where I urge people not to jump on that social storm, if you will, on media. And take some time to breathe and think about it. Even little actions like this are kind of a problem in the sense that you're acting like a mob when you do it without full information.
Yeah. There have been a number of cases like this. The other one that that sticks out in my mind is in, I think it was mid-November with the whole New Balance thing, where Matt LeBreton, the company's vice president for communications, told the Wall Street Journal last week, according to this article, which was in mid-November, that, quote, "we feel things are going to move in the right direction," end quote, under Donald Trump. So you take that out of context and you think, ah, okay, they're pro-Donald Trump. And that's how most people took it. But the context of that comment was in the context of Trump's opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And they were saying that that trade deal would hurt its production of shoes in the U.S. while rewarding competitors that make more of the products overseas. So again, it feels like people took it in the opposite way as it was meant, and then it became a viral thing when people posted videos of them burning their New Balance shoes and things like that. So again, it feels like
and really what New Balance said was, if this goes through, it's going to be better for us as a company. They're just being honest about their bottom line, really.
In the United States.
Right.
So now more than ever, for more reasons ever than ever, it's important to fact check and it's important to get the context of things before you interpret and take action.
Mm-hmm.
It's so easy, the mob mentality.
Yeah, slow and steady wins the race. Don't try to be the first.
And the Delete Uber campaign had a different impact, and we know that not from Uber's numbers, but Apple releases stats and just kind of always has stats on their apps in their store. And Lyft surged to top 10 on the Apple store.
Surged, good use of the word there.
Lyft basically is now in the top 10, and that happened because probably people deleted Uber. It's associated. So you see an immediate impact.
Yeah. Also, Lyft made what I would call probably a smart business decision. And while this was all going down, they made a $1 million donation to the ACLU and were very vocal about it. So, you know, they
Lyft did or Uber?
Lyft did.
Oh, smart.
Lyft did, yeah. Side note, if you want to donate to someone, the ACLU is really wonderful. they're the organization that got the federal judge to put the stay on the executive order for immigration.
Brian, can I ask you quickly, what's going on with your Google smart home device? How are things going for you at home?
Well,
have you figured out APIs and all that?
It's kind of moved.
Are you programming your smart home device?
No. But I was given one for Christmas, and it was really wonderful in my living room, and the kids always like to play different game show games that it allows you to do, and plays music. It's kind of disappeared because my wife seems to have taken it over for her office.
So she likes it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's using it all the time.
And she's using it for music?
Largely for music, which I understand the speaker is a little bit better than the Amazon Echo.
Oh, that's interesting.
It does sound good. Although every time I come to your house to hear the Amazon, there's some kids in the background screaming, so I could never tell how good it was.
The Maggie's listening, using the Amazon one, moves it around the house for books on tape, audio books. So the other day it moved into a back bedroom, and she asked me to set a timer for something we were cooking, and I said, command word, set a timer for it. And I looked over and the thing wasn't there and it wasn't blue sparkling. I already started speaking, right? And I stopped and it felt like someone had left the room when I wasn't expecting them to leave the room. You know, when you're doing something, you look up and your friend has left because they walked away to get something. Like this happened today when we were getting snacks before the show. You went to the restroom, Brian. And I looked up and was like, where's Brian? It was like the startling. I had that experience of like talking and where's Echo?
Yeah,
I'm sorry, and command word.
You feel personally... What, offended?
It was just startling. And then, of course, I laughed how I was expecting it to be there. And it felt like I lacked a conversational thing with, of course, completely not a human at all. Even though emotionally, to me, it felt like someone left. Really interesting. you've got an update on these word things.
I have now used both an Amazon Echo and a Google Home. And I like the Google Home better. But Amazon did do one thing that's pretty cool. I don't have my Echo anymore, unfortunately. I gave it to actually a friend of mine and a coworker of yours who set it up and now has a home device where they wouldn't. Amazon now has a new wake word. and the wake word. Apologies if you, well, actually, if you've set this to your wake word, your echo has gone off a lot because the new wake word is computer.
Yeah.
So if you're listening to us talk about computers, well, your echo's going off a lot.
Now, if only the trigger word was made so it was computer. Just like
computer.
Star
Trek 4 specifically.
Yes.
But I mean, every episode of Star Trek, they refer to their computer as computer and the computer response.
Does this mean Majel Barrett is going to record the sound for the voice?
She's not alive anymore.
Of course.
I'm sorry. but yeah, that's really lovely. As a Star Trek fan, unfortunately, it still cannot make Earl Grey tea.
Nice.
Or I should say tea Earl Grey hot.
So did you hear the story about the – I think it was the Amazon one was triggering all the time when television commercials would come on to advertise it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that was so right. I saw a YouTube video of someone who had filmed that ad and their Echo.
Okay. And so Amazon's running these ads to advertise the Echo. And, of course, in the ad, people use command words. And they're using the command words to exemplify how the system works. But, of course, if you have a television and then in the same space is your device, it's going to do what the command word was, which is frustrating. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden, one day, the ad stopped triggering it. And someone grabbed audio copy of the ad and found that there was a 5 kilohertz notch in the audio output.
And 5 kilohertz?
I think it was a 5 kilohertz notch. So it was a very thin audio notch that basically dropped the audio in this band.
Not a thing that a human would hear.
Not a thing a human would hear.
What do you mean by a notch?
Oh, so if you take a waveform and you look at it from a low frequency to high frequency spectrum analyzer, you can actually see where the audio is coming from. If you just do a filter such that nothing at 5K produces any voltage, you'll have it's like a spike. Like a tone, but it's a negative of tone. It's a drop of sound. There's no sound in that space.
Absence of sound in that particular frequency range.
Right.
So if you had a really, really detailed, what do you call audio?
Spectrogram.
Oh, I forgot the name of it. You know, where you change the bass or
the pitch.
Equalizer.
Oh, equalizer.
Yeah, if you had a very detailed equalizer, just worked on a very narrow band, it's the same thing.
Yeah, and that's called a notch filter.
Oh.
So that's why the notch. But
actually, some humans have this too when they have very specific
hearing impairments.
Yes. Right? Yes. Like if you can't hear a particular tone, like if you can't hear the tone that a CRT TV makes.
We have a dryer vent at our house for our dryer, and it whistles. I can't hear it. And
really,
it drives my wife crazy. Wow. Just because I don't have the high frequency, I can't hear that frequency.
That's probably just because you can't hear that high anymore.
Yeah, it might not be a notch kind of thing. Yeah. But in any case, that's how they solved it. I think if I remember the story right, I haven't looked it up. So they did that. So now, technically, if I wanted to be really nice to everybody, I'd go research that and then edit the GeekSpeak episode so that it just didn't produce that frequency, and then we could talk anything we want. But I don't know if Google is implementing the same type of thing. What I think would be really interesting is if everybody implemented that. Mm-hmm. In fact, like your TV could just have like a filter that didn't produce that frequency. That'd be pretty cool. But I don't think it's common yet anytime. Moving on. Yes?
Sure.
So you can say computer, but
computer.
Not Earl Grey.
Can you do it with the accent?
Hello, computer. No, that's wrong. That was almost a little like awkward Russian.
So, Brian, you want to talk about some wish lists?
I want to take a moment and just take a deep breath and think about what these last 10 years have been since the introduction of the first modern smartphone. So it's been a little bit over 10 years since what they call the keynote to end all keynotes, where Steve Jobs introduces the iPhone. But look at all of the changes that have happened socially and technologically mm-hmm. since we've had not only iPhones but Android smartphones in our pocket. We are now sharing things on the go, looking up information on the go constantly. We are now, it's affecting our culture in multiple ways. There are people that make the case that the election of Donald Trump, the political movement that put him there, the everything leading up to that is because we have these modern smartphones and what it's done to how we communicate, what we talk about, how quickly it spreads. So we've talked a lot about fake news, and we've talked a lot about what this election has meant as far as how technology may have been involved. But maybe fake news isn't actually the problem, but it's the symptom. So what this article is that I'm going to be referring to, most of the concepts are coming from it, is that maybe the fundamental problem that we're dealing with is we're sharing too much and we're involved too much in all the different information sources coming our way. Maybe the problem is that we need to cut some of these things back in our life in some way. So we've seen articles and apps about limiting your use of social media on your computer, mm-hmm. or they've tried to make apps like this for iPhones and Android. Of course, with Android, you can hook into the operating system enough that you can make something that really enforces how much you can use an app.
So, like, kind of turn it off for certain hours of the day so that you reduce the amount of time you commit to it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But with Apple, with an iPhone, you don't have the control as a developer to put in these system-level blockages or time limits on anything.
There are capabilities in iOS to do that. It's part of the business process space where you can actually – I have an app actually that you can install on your kids' phones, and you can turn off all devices except – all apps except for the core apps on the device remotely.
Okay, so remotely you can turn them off for certain times of the day?
You can, just toggle them whenever you want.
Okay, you're talking, yeah.
You can also set up scheduling. This is all about the mechanism allows you to remote erase a phone, right? So at the office, we actually have all of our phones that have private company business on them can be remotely erased. In that way, if I lose it, I can ask somebody to erase it for me. And that also can control what apps go on it, though we don't take advantage of that here. So there is methodology in place for that in the operating system, but it's not user-driven. It's like corporate server-driven. So go on.
Oh, sure. But obviously, we know these kind of things could be built into the operating system. Well, is it likely that Google would do something to Android that would allow people to reduce engagement of their services or of all services?
Interesting. Yeah, what's their motivation to do that?
They don't have one. Like we mentioned earlier, many of these companies started with investors, and they started with non-monetized products. Mm-hmm. And in cases like that, the user becomes monetized in some way. And so engagement has been the currency that these different services have been built on over the last 10 or 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So this author is making the case that the company that has the motivations to be able to take this somewhere would be Apple, because more than just about any other tech company I can think of, they directly sell their products and their services for money. They aren't trying to monetize it too much
I got to argue right off the bat, because if you don't use your smartphone as much because Apple has implemented something that helps you kind of control the amount of time you use it.
Right.
When the new smartphone comes out, you might not want to upgrade because you don't use it as much. You don't see the pain of not having the best and brightest.
Right.
So there is a motivation to keep people really excited about their phone. So when new ones come out, they buy the new one.
Yeah, but it's about control. If you decide as a user that you want to take control over your phone and not feel like it's taking control of you. Let me back up. There's studies that posting or checking on social media, looking for a like or posting something and getting a reaction, there's a dopamine hit that comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
We literally get addicted to all of these different sources of news and all of these ways of interacting with people.
Yeah.
So if people recognize that as a problem, why not give people tools to deal with that? And of course, there's this user interface problem on what tools you give them, how many dials you give them to twiddle. Mm-hmm. It has to be made easy enough and default so that it's actually in wide use. But it's not just whether you're able to use an app for so many hours or use it during these hours. It's also things like all the notifications that we get coming into our phone. Or even when you unlock the lock screen, what's the first thing that happens when you unlock the lock screen and you see your home screen? You see two or three apps that have numbers on them.
Little badges.
You got to go check me. You got to look at me. And I know that I do this all the time. It's easy to get distracted. What was I going to do? Was I actually going to go call my wife?
So
some
of these things have easy solutions. Like, you can turn off badges on your phone.
Yes.
On Android and iOS. You can just go into the settings and say, I don't want to be notified when Facebook posts or when Instagram posts are there. But the thing is, I sometimes do. Like, when I'm in a dialogue and engaged, I do. But I think it's true that, like, taking ownership of this at some level makes sense. The do not disturb thing makes a lot of sense. Do you guys use that feature on your phones? Uh-huh.
All the time. In fact, it's on there right now.
It's on right now? Oh, yeah. Cool. I should have done that before we started the show. My phone's been buzzing like crazy. that's a pretty useful feature. Does yours have alarms? Does your alarms go through it? What goes through
it
for you?
If you choose.
Okay.
Yeah, so for me, I have it set when...
And I'm talking to you, Ben, specifically because of Android. I just don't know how it works. You use Android as your primary.
Yeah, I have do not disturb turned on from, I think, 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. automatically, and then I can also turn it on manually. And it always lets alarms through and never lets anything else through.
And if somebody calls you, like if I were to call you at 12 o'clock at night.
I wouldn't get it.
You wouldn't get
although it? Although I think that there are
what if I called twice?
There are settings to say if someone calls you two times within 5 minutes, then it'll ring the second time.
Do you have that on?
No, I just haven't bothered to do that.
If you had children, you probably have that one on.
I've been meaning to turn it on.
I think I have. There's also you can in iOS. I think you can actually specify a group of people if they're in your favorites and they call you at late at night. It will ring. Definitely important. I think that taking control of this makes a lot of sense because I definitely find the situation where I'll look at a badge and go, "Oh, I got to check that."
So it feels like this is the same. This isn't the same problem in a lot of ways that we've always faced, but there is a part of it that is the same problem, one of the same problems that we've always faced, which is my grandma is not going to go into the settings for anything.
Right.
Of course. This is the default.
This is what is the default and what's the best default for the maximum number of people, or what's a way of bringing people through that customization flow without them having to opt into it, right?
Right.
Because very few people, I'm odd because when I get a new device or a new piece of software, the very first place I go is settings to see what I can change. But very few people go in there at all, right?
Do you get a lot of notifications and badges for like new email and things?
Well, I hate using my phone, so I haven't done that on my newest phone.
Oh, interesting. But normally you do.
Yeah. Also, it's a little bit difficult because work notifications and personal notifications are a little bit different, and so it can be a little tricky to customize those to be exactly what you want them to be, because I need to set them differently for the two.
Oh, and the tools you use at work is actually Facebook, which is also your social.
Right.
It's kind of
they actually
for you.
They are separated out into two different apps. For me. So that's good. But it's just not something I've put enough effort into.
Yeah.
But I'm also a settings power user, so like if I haven't done it. How can we as engineers expect
I totally agree. At the same time, 10 years ago, we didn't have these things. We didn't think about it. Now we have them. And they're a big part of our life. We really should think about how we want to engage with it. Mm-hmm. It just kind of crept into our world where I just check Instagram all the time. And it makes more sense for me to say, well, how much time do I want to engage with this? Which services do I want to be notified for? I keep on trying, a service that I don't use very often, and it keeps notifying me, but I kind of ignore it. But that little buzz is kind of irritating.
Yeah.
So it definitely should probably spend more time pruning the systems in place to make it so my life is not as cluttered.
I went off the grid in Costa Rica for a week, about a month ago. And I kept feeling my phone buzzing in my pocket, but it wasn't. It wasn't in my pocket.
That's
the phantom
great.
Buzz, right?
Wow.
Just my body is used to that input, and then when it was absent, it started making it up. It's kind of interesting.
Brian, what do you do? Do you turn off notifications?
So I have been on a campaign to. Yes, turn off notifications when I get something from an app. So, of course, it takes some effort to go find in the notification settings that app which just sent a notification to me that I want to turn off. I don't have Force Touch on my iPhone. Is there a shortcut to turn off notifications from a particular app from the
on
notification
Android,
itself?
There is. If you go from the notification and you hold down, you long press on it, then it'll pop up and there's a way to turn off notifications globally for that particular app.
Right. And, of course, Android's been ahead of the notification game from pretty much the beginning. And I've wished that on iOS – notifications gave me more control for multiple reasons. I see it kind of as a unified inbox for the whole phone, except for I can't control that inbox. Mm-hmm. If I miss it, if I accidentally dismiss it before I had a chance to read it, I want to see what that was, and there's no place to go back to
see
it.
Every dismiss it, it goes away from the view that you can get from the pull down. No, Force Touch does not give you going to settings. that would be great if all apps went to settings and notification settings specifically. So to be clear, in an iOS environment, you've got the application itself, and then also you have settings for the application. And inside settings for the application, which can have custom settings, do take a look at the ones you use a lot because they're really interesting. There's normally a notifications area inside that. And also there's an area called notifications where you can, in the settings app, where you can see all of them kind of at a glance with little icons and you can tap them through. But you're right, it does take a long time to work on them.
Yeah. In fact, one thing I would say is I found Siri kind of helpful to be able to get to some of these settings because there's shortcuts by just asking Siri to show me the notifications or show me other settings.
Very cool. Like, look at that.
So I wish there was an inbox or some way to control it that was just easier, some way that I didn't have to go fishing all the way deep down into the settings each time I wanted to do that.
I think that a really big part of the solution is going to be AI, artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that as we kind of push forward in that space, we're going to build AIs that can learn our notification preferences in general by the way that we interact with it, potentially also flag certain kinds of usages that could be harmful,
mm-hmm.
and then dial those back without us directly working with it.
Actually, this is something the author brings up, which I did think was interesting, is it if you start looking at the behavior of the user, you should be able to detect if somebody is in some sort of Skinner box mode where they're just going back again and again and again because it's habitual.
Right.
I also want to mention that notifications with Facebook, I use them quite a bit. You can actually have close friends in Facebook. I don't know what they're called. But
yeah, close friends, I think.
Close friends. And you don't have to have that mutual assignment. Like I can assign somebody a close friend without them actually changing the setting.
Oh.
But then you can also say, now when any of my close friends post, I want to be notified by them and not by other things. There's a lot of features in there, which is, I mean, it's a complicated problem. But this means that whenever you post on Facebook, Brian, I see it. And whenever Ben posts on Facebook, I see it. In fact, I see notifications on my phone. Most people in my life do not, right? Most people in my close life do, but most people in my extended life do not get posted that way. And that's how I actually am able to use it. There's a few side effects that are tricky, like when you have a page that's shared by many people. Like, so I manage the page for the community theater in Ben Lomond and the community hall in Ben Lomond, and lots of people do. Well, I can't turn off that notification without affecting all the admins, so I just have this kind of noise. So I can remove myself from it because I don't work that much on it, but I also am there for support and backup. So there's the boundaries levels are complicated. But I definitely urge you, especially when an important feature like Facebook or something where a lot of your communication's through it, go ahead and go into those settings and spend an hour thinking about what you want it to do, because it will work better for you if you do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that nobody does that. I mean, 99% of the people don't do this.
Yeah. Facebook has a thing called privacy checkup, I think is what it's called.
Yeah, checkup.
And every once in a while, they'll say hey, this just a reminder, this post that you're writing, these people can see it. Is that what you want?
Yeah, that's a good, I think that's a good level of reminder. Yeah. Definitely useful.
It's kind of, it feels like the first step towards a more intelligent system. Like if you put a little me inside of everyone's phone, I probably would have opinions on what is addictive behavior and what's not, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not particularly smart as an AI, nor am I very scalable, nor can you cram me in a teeny little box. But if you wrote an algorithm that could somehow do something like that, I mean, hence the term artificial intelligence, right? It's intelligence-y, then potentially we could get better results with no additional cost to the user, because nobody wants to go into their settings.
You know, in listening to your other radio show, Ben, I think a lot about how you train computer systems, and the feedback loop is the essential part of the training process. This
right.
says, this is a successful step, move more in this direction. That question is very challenging, because the way that our online services work is, in a Google search, the person stopped searching and potentially landed on that page. So that's probably more likely that's a good answer. And then in the Netflix place, it's, oh, well, more people, when we did this algorithm, more people actually played movies more. So that means that one. In Facebook, people spent more time on the phone or wrote more on the phone, some other aspect. But it's all about what's going on in the system, right? Not about how well you slept last night, which, of course, what we're talking mm-hmm. about with this kind of checking consistently is about how it affects the rest of your life. And how would you actually gauge that to allow the system to get better at that? You know, you could definitely tell the AI, hey, the focus here for small band in a box is this person should spend time on their social networks for about an hour a day and no more than 15 different times, right? Like
right.
some rule that says kind of condense your time to certain areas, maybe do it in the evening after dinner, you know? And that AI would at some level work. But of course, if the person is someone who has a night job, that's the wrong pattern to give it, right?
Right?
So it has to have a feedback of what the person's life is like. And we don't have that system
in place
yet.
And this is kind of, I think, why generally speaking, one provider of one service, like using Facebook as the example, is probably not the entity that can do it the best, right? Because like if you let's say I use Facebook on my computer – but then my phone has all kinds of sensors. It can give you feedback on like how well I'm sleeping or how much I'm exercising or how long during the day I'm awake or whatever those things are, right? So the more data that you have to put into this system, into this algorithm, the more the algorithm can potentially measure success on a number of different
ways. Last week's show with Dawn, we talked a lot about, I mean, her feeling is the reason why we're so behind the times in our medical knowledge has to do with the lack of centralized and aggregated data. And in countries where you see a lot of data being coalesced over long periods of time, you start seeing the side effects of, oh, look, this kind of diet or this kind of drug actually causes these kind of long-term effects. We just don't have that data because we don't have a centralized repository of that kind of data. Because of privacy concerns, but also because of the capitalistic market in regards to medical information. And so, yeah, you could get a lot of benefit from a system like that, but you also have that siloed problem.
Right. And actually, there's a lot of data to back that up as well. There have been a lot of studies. And actually, Joe Biden called a cancer moonshot thing to try and do, I think, what was it, 5 years of cancer research, 10 years of cancer research in 5 years or something like that, right? And
basically
Katie,
collecting all the tests.
Right, yeah. And Katie, my co-host, was part of that. And one of the things that the one key finding that they found was because of privacy and all of these other things, you've got all these siloed pieces of sources of data. And if you could only bring them together and also somehow get these pieces of data that were all collected using different methodologies and different ways and with different metrics
somehow coalesce into one system. Yeah.
Like somehow get those to talk. And there's so many complicated issues with that.
Yeah.
But if you could, oh my gosh, we could move so much faster.
And I agree with you that it can't really be one of these services that decides to do this. It has to be like a governmental level or a operating system level that allows you to kind of coalesce this meaning. I'm assuming that this kind of system will emerge as we want digital assistants to be better at what they do.
It could be a startup if a bunch of companies opt into working with it.
Right. Like, and then you have to think about the privacy concerns and all those different things. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's
tricky.
It's
but, you know, Apple did a really smart thing by taking and really focusing on medical contact information or medical information in your phone being siloed and having to grant privilege and stuff. Because, of course, like right now, if you use any iOS app to deal with fitness or diet or, you know, exercise in general, their system's most likely going to save that data to a data store which is organized and owned by the operating system, owned by you, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and you have control of who gets to see that data.
Yeah, and that, and in a lot of ways, that makes a lot of sense because you should be the one in control of it. One last story, and this is just for the people in California. Ben, what should people go see?
Oh, yeah, the Computer History Museum.
Do you like the Computer History Museum?
I love it. I've been there a couple times. I've always been impressed with the way that they illustrate concepts and stuff. I walked through their exhibit that started with an abacus. And it went all the way through all the supercomputers and everything and landed at the modern day computer and the iPad and Pixar films and all of this stuff. It was pretty cool. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Anyway,
this is Mountain View, right?
This is in Mountain View. This is right near the Google campus, actually, too. So you can wander around there and take a picture with a bunch of Android statues if you go. But they also just released a new exhibit at the museum just as of the recording of this, which is January 30th, 2 days ago, January 28th, they opened up Make Software Change the World. And I'll just read this one short paragraph, which is on their website. It says, Make Software explores the history, impact, and technology behind seven game-changing applications: MP3, Photoshop, MRI, car crash simulation, Wikipedia, texting, and World of Warcraft.
Cool. I want to go to this.
The Stata Family Foundation Software Lab is at the center of the exhibition, where visitors are introduced to basic computer programming concepts and encouraged to try coding hands-on. So if you've never coded before, or if you have family who has never coded before, this might be a really fun thing to do. So that way, when they ask you what you do next Christmas, well, you can just take them here and
awesome. They
can do it a little themselves.
Brian, it sounds like we got a day trip for the kids.
Yeah, I've been meaning to take them there for a while. Do they still have the difference engine on display?
Oh, unfortunately not. No, what was that? Babbage?
Babbage machine, yeah.
Yeah.
I saw it when I was there last
incredible, time. Incredible, huge calculator.
Metal calculator.
massive calculator. And I think they would run it twice a day, I think.
Yeah.
They would give a long presentation talking about what it actually does and how it's differentiating things and whatnot.
And basically, it's a giant, complicated printer. It prints out logarithmic sheets.
Oh yeah, it's really cool. It's a calculator and printer.
Well,
it's
crank printer.
Yay. Crank printer.
Incredibly, incredibly beautiful piece of machinery, and he worked on it for a really, really long time and never finished it. And he kind of, as most historical figures who then become famous and musicians and artists and sculptors and painters, totally got screwed during his lifetime. And now everyone's like, yeah, this guy was a genius. And the thing that he built, which was not ever fully built during his lifetime, totally worked when they built it.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Pretty cool.
And they had to make very minimal changes. Anyway, that is not on. And I've talked about that for so long. That is not on display anymore. They had borrowed it from somebody who owns it, and then that person, after several years of having it on loan to the Computer History Museum, said, yeah, I want my engine back.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark. David Lawrence is user permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use your stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know we sent you. Today's working title by our Canadian correspondent, Greg Merkley, is Microblog Injections with Lift Your Chimera. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. And Ben Jaffe and Brian Young, thank you so much for joining us for episode 4 of season 17.
It's great to be here.
Always a pleasure. Miles always says that.
Yeah, I think
why
so.
Did I say that?
I don't know. I liked it.
Because you want to represent Miles today?
Yeah. Always a pleasure.
Hey, this week I'm doing this project at home, which is pulling out a furnace and putting a new furnace in. And we've lived at this house for
why?
Because the furnace we had didn't work.
Okay.
Well, I should say the repair person.
Because I remember it worked just fine.
No, we've always had a fireplace at our house.
Well,
oh, a fireplace and furnace are different.
A wood, yes. You're thinking the wood stove that's in the living room.
Wait, you have a stove and a furnace and a fireplace?
Okay, so a wood stove.
Hold on a second. Take us through your house now.
A fireplace is a very inefficient way to burn wood. If you just take wood and you put it in an open cavity and have a chimney, a lot of air shoots up. And the material doesn't burn efficiently. Mm-hmm. So what you want is kind of a catalytic converter kind of capability where you superheat the exhaust the gas and burn it more. And so to do that, you need a closed chamber, and that is called a wood stove. That's what I have used for my primary heating in my house.
That's your wood stove.
Yes.
That you did not replace.
No, that is still there.
High technology from the 1700s.
That's right. And this wood stove, we go through about 6 cords of wood a year. That's a lot of wood. Maybe
what's
4. A cord of wood is a horrible measurement mechanism. Brian, do you know the stats? It's like 4 foot by 4 foot by 6 foot, or 4 foot by 3 foot by 6 foot?
It's something like that. Yeah.
It's a volumetric measurement of wood?
Yes. How else would you measure
like
wood?
Is this with no air gaps?
Well, that's the thing. You can stack it multiple ways, and yes.
It's a packing problem, but you can never get all the air out, right? I mean, unless you like jump on top of the wood.
That's why the people that sell us wood, we always reduce money from the last minute from them. Not really.
What?
So
you burned a lot of wood.
We burn a lot of wood. We don't want to burn a lot of wood. And we also have a furnace that's propane-based. And when we had the system cleaned and looked at a few years ago, the guy said, yeah, you can use this. Just don't put anything burnable around it, because at some point the heating exchanger is going to fail and a giant fume of gas ball will fire out at the front of it. So don't put anything burnable. So just be careful. And I'm like, this is an old redwood house. Like, all the beams are redwood. Everything's burnt.
Don't
everything's
put anything
flammable.
Burnable in front of it?
Yes. So we just don't use it. But this January is so cold. That's the furnace. So this, and we also have a stove. The stove would be like a stove for cooking. So wood stove versus stove is different.
Woods, really?
You have a stove in your house.
Okay.
Okay. And an oven.
Wait, I have a question. Wood stove is not a stove that works with wood. It's a stove for burning wood.
Okay, so a wood stove is both a stove and a cooking implement. But we, as we've gotten better at just having really controlled kitchen stoves, we've separated them. So now we have heating wood stoves and we have normal stoves.
We as in humanity?
Humanity in general. But traditionally, a wood stove is also a cooking instrument. When it used to be that we had less services, you'd have a wood stove in your house. On the top would be a spot for pans. You could open it up. You could bake in it. You could cook in it. It would have an oven next to it. That's what
well,
I grew up
this
with.
This is a whole world I didn't even know existed.
Come over to my house. Mine has a cooking service.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, that sounds good. And it's really convenient, actually, to be able to heat stuff, and especially when the power goes out.
Like
so,
soup or something.
The furnace process, though, I've never really dealt with ducting and folding metal.
Well, ducting as in duct tape.
Yes, that's actually interesting. The thing that you think of as duct tape is actually duct tape. The silvery colored tape that we call duct tape, and you've probably heard people say, no, it's not duct tape, it's duct tape. Actually, that's duct tape, not duct tape.
Whoa.
No, it is duct tape.
No.
There's duct tape and duct tape.
So, yeah. So the silver stuff you can think of that you might have made fake swords with and taped a...
But that's duct tape for ducts.
It's not. It is the worst tape you could possibly use for putting ducts together.
No.
The silver tape that you think of as duct tape...
Like the gray silver
the
stuff.
The gray silver tape is the worst kind of ducting tape you could possibly use.
Because... But I have bought it and it says duct on it.
That's because we
wrong.
Got lost in our knowledge about what this stuff is. The reason why that tape is so cool is it's waterproof, like a duck. It is duct tape.
Hold on, though.
Okay, I'm looking this up.
Because all the duct tape.
Have you ever used it for a duct?
No. Have you ever used it for a duck?
No.
Right. Exactly my point.
But I have used it in situations where I want it to stay with water.
Okay.
That's how it got popularized. So, in any case, I'm using actually a silvered aluminum tape, which is actually aluminum foil that's kind of thick with a glue background.
Wait, hold on.
Brian, tell us all. He researched it.
Wikipedia agrees with Lyle because it comes from plain cotton duck cloth.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Yeah. What, you think I was making it up?
Yes.
But the duct tape, I'm now correcting myself, the duct tape that I bought before has not said duck as in...
So this is the great thing is that over time, people thought, no, it's not duct tape. That's stupid. It's duct tape for putting ducks together. So then the popular meme was, it's not... People would correct you. People would be like, not duct tape. It's duct tape.
How many pedants do we have to go back and find?
So then people got so upset about it, they started changing the name to duct tape, and that became that. If you use this tape that is duct tape, the silver stuff, on ducks, the glue backing comes off, and the tape just falls off.
Why would you use
off.
It on a duck?
No, it's duct.
Terrible.
Okay. I just want to make one observation.
You can see this tape. He can't fly with all this tape on it.
I know.
He's really dry.
A poor guy. No, he was trying to expand his wings. Okay. What was I even going to say? Oh, yeah. The fact
you're
going to
make a joke about ducking a duck.
No, I wasn't. That's animal cruelty. I was going to say the fact that we are still talking about this is evidence that we are geeks.
Definitely. Let me tell you about this aluminum tape, fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen
that. Aluminum tape. Okay.
This is just – you can
and
buy like a roll for like $8.
On ducts.
It's
with
what you
tape.
Use on ducts.
Got
yes.
it. Okay. So this is the real duct tape.
Yeah. So what you're doing with ducting, if you're – I don't do circular ducting. The house has old ducting, and this ducting, unfortunately, is wrapped with an insulator. And the insulator is – what do you think it might be?
Fiberglass? No.
No, that'd be great. So
it's the
in the 40s,
stuff, right?
I'm not even sure when it stopped, We use this kind of insulation everywhere. It was great.
Oh,
you
asbestos.
It's asbestos. Oh, it's so wonderful. So I'm dealing with old asbestos ducting, and I'm kind of reworking it. And so a lot of filters and a lot of cleaning and all that. The deal with asbestos is you just don't want to particulate it and get it in your lungs. That's the reason you want to avoid. So I only did that the first day, and after that I stopped. In any case, folding, what you're doing is you're folding metal and you're kind of putting together like a puzzle piece. Ben, you'd love this. It's really kind of fun. And get the right tools and you can really make any shape you want. And you're thinking in three-dimensional space with flat surfaces and kind of merging them together and then screwing them together. And then after that, you then tape them with this tape, which is just like, imagine really thick aluminum foil in about a 2-inch wide, and it's really sticky. It has a double backing, like a paper backing that you peel off. And when it goes on smooth, it looks like metal. It's like, I don't know. It's really cool. I want to make stuff with it.
It's got to be really good adhesion to not wear out in the heat that goes through those.
It's got good adhesion.
That's why they call it adhesion.
It's probably very similar to duct tape adhesion, but the metal doesn't fall apart in weather like duct tape does.
I still have this compulsion to correct you, but now I know I'm wrong.
I'm loving that you're eating something and trying to say duck and duct. Because it's very hard to not have that consonant sound when you have something.
Dried pineapple is great for eating on a podcast.
It's okay. It's the post show. Why not?
Can we talk about Objective-C and JavaScript duct typing?
Oh, God.
By the way, Miles corrected us on the chat about ducts. No, about JavaScript types. C is like a static type. JavaScript is a strict type. But you don't declare the type. It infers.
Right, yeah.
Are we done?
Mm-hmm. What happened with your furnace?
So I've spent a lot of time learning about furnaces and ducting, and I just have to say that I did it myself because I like doing things myself, but I have actually really quite enjoyed building with metal. I started welding a little while ago too, and making metal stuff is fun. Woodworking is a lot harder. And I spent a lot of time doing woodworking.
Woodworking is harder than metalworking?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, that's the thing that's crazy is that...
I have not gotten into metalworking because I felt like that would be harder.
Right, so...
Well, without tools.
So if you get good gloves... Good point. If all you have is a badger, make sure you work with wood. So Ben, you've got to have a few things. You have to have tin snips, which basically allow you to cut metal, big shears. And there's like three different types, straight cut, left cut, and right cut.
What?
Not that important.
But
okay. Basically, it's how it curves the material up.
Oh,
so
okay.
So the one color, the red ones, curve the material on the left and kind of cause it to be damaged. And the right ones, the green ones, curve it the right side material up and damage it. And then the straight ones cut straight. But if you have a sheet of metal and you try to cut really straight in it, you actually run into a problem because the snippers run into the edge, right? So anyway, you use these tools. So you can have those. And then a crimper for actually causing the metal to bend. It looks like a big... A grabber, big flat grabber, and you can use it to push the metal and compress it. And then a drill gun with screw heads. Like, you just screw them together. And I know you make a lot of stuff at the house, like you like make stuff around your house to make things better.
Yeah.
Yeah. You would like working with sheet metal. It's fun. Oh, gloves, essential, and eye protection, because the metal is really, really sharp.
Yeah.
I urge you to make some things with sheet metal. I'll give you some sheet metal if you'd like. You can get some of my scrap and just... make some stuff. It's fun. Anyway, that's all.
Sounds good.
What have you made lately?
Not much. Last couple of months, I've been a little depressed.
Great.
At the world.
Brian, what have you made lately?
Oh, just making apps.
Just making apps.
Yeah.
That's
Which
good.
Is great. I love doing it, but it's kind of gotten away from
my
woodworking.
I love it so much. Yeah,
true. I built a loft in my house a while back, and I've been slowly adding things to the loft. The great thing about the loft is – so first of all, it's in our living room. It's elevated. There's an area underneath it, and there are two queen-size mattresses side by side on top of it.
When you walk under it, do you have to duct?
I have to duct, yeah. I have to duct. That's right. Yeah, if you're on top of it, obviously it'll hold your weight. If you're underneath it, it will also hold your weight. And so I've been attaching hammocks to it and what are those things that you hang upside down beginner's silk kit thing that you can buy on Amazon for like $100 or whatever. And
this must be a different generational thing. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Like acrobatic silks. It's okay. Like that, but
Very old stuff.
But like simpler and easier to use and less risky. So I attach those underneath and I can like do a little backflips and stuff. And it's nice to be able to move my body in that way. I haven't been able to do that since I was 10 because now everything is too small or I'm too big to like do backflips.
I think everything's too small.
Or like if I jump into a somersault, I'm going to break my neck because I'm a little too tall now. So it's kind of fun to have those handles and things.
Cool.
Swing around like a monkey under there. Yeah.
Pineapple, dried pineapple face.
I'm eating an apple now.
Oh, okay. You're forgiven.
I've been hungry this whole show.
I couldn't tell.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.